Hi, the environmental activist George Monbiot, who fell out with most of his fellow environmentalists a few years ago by recommending that they reconsider their attitude towards nuclear power because Monbiot had come to the conclusion that he'd been wrong earlier and that probably nuclear power was a lot safer than anyone realised and a lot more. Likely to give you a stable base load for electricity generation than anything else, and therefore was highly compatible with things that gave you variable power, like wind and wave, and I suppose wave's more predictable, obviously, but wind and solar. So Monbiot, as I say, is somebody that's able to actually think and admit that he has thought and that he's come to a different conclusion, and that's a considerable feather in his cap when you compare him to an awful lot of his fellow travellers. So he's an interesting guy, and as I say, he said things in the past that I thought were interesting, such as the use of buses to connect major cities and then have those buses connect to the urban bus network. And if you can run buses highly efficiently using convoys, essentially, so the buses are close to each other, managed by computers, low air resistance, low rolling resistance tyres, you can have quite an environmentally friendly transport system without the heavy investment in additional new things like, for example, HS2. So Monbiot, as I say, is an interesting guy, and he's got a piece in The Guardian about the planning system and the so-called right to build. Now, what he's doing is making a case which rests on a number of assumptions about how societies operate and what taxation and planning should look like, and he makes them without stating them. So he's making what I would call a case in nous, in other words, a single case that's held to stand for a lot of other things. And just I'd like to very quickly look at that case in nous and then take more time to look at the assumptions in which the broader argument rests. Now, most of us are familiar with the expression NIMBY, not in my backyard. There's an old saying about losing weight, which is that everyone's in favour of losing weight in general and cake in particular. Everyone's in favour of hospitals, and everyone knows you have to have incinerators for some kinds of waste. Everyone knows there has to be landfill. Everyone knows that lots and lots of community facilities that are absolutely vital but maybe unattractive have to be built somewhere. So people are in favour of having these things built. Just not near them. So NIMBYism is not in my backyard, and it is the bane of Britain's planning, because what happens is that local councillors who are highly responsive to the most vocal elements in their community and generally motivated to try and become members of the Scottish Parliament or Welsh Assembly or members of the Westminster Parliament, these local councillors who often have control of planning decisions will respond to local concerns by denying planning permission where a reasonable objective view of what should happen would suggest it should go ahead. There's then appeal processes up to secretaries of state, and what then happens is that the secretary of state, if they belong to the same party as local councillors, if they've got marginal seats in the local area, they'll take the same view as the councillors. So the whole thing becomes contaminated by the worst kind of party politics. So NIMBYism is a huge problem. In 2010, 2011, the coalition government, obviously influenced both by the Tory party's rural England and suburbia response to community concerns about planning, and also the Liberal Democrats' favouring of localism, they introduced legislation which allowed communities the right to build if they could get wider community support. So what that effectively did was it devolved planning decisions to some degree past the councillors to the community itself, and therefore it allowed the local community, including those who might, for example, get jobs in an enterprise, to have a direct say. And it, without wishing to be too cynical about it, went over the heads of retired primary school head teachers who were active in the local Conservative Association. So by having a general referendum as your planning mechanism, you do something to take away power from the electorate. In other words, the group of people who involve themselves with local politics, select local party candidates for election, and generally will run things to their own preference and advantage if they can. So that was the legislation, and it was made use of in this particular case that Monbiot wants to talk about in Totnes in Devon, a site that had lain derelict since 2007 and was a bit of a mess. Was going to be developed by the local community following a successful referendum to provide affordable housing and workplace facilities, workshops, and retirement homes, the kind of things which someone as cynical and sarcastic as me would refer to as motherhood and apple pie. It's very difficult to get people to object to affordable housing or affordable retirement homes. So this Totnes Community Action Group drew up these designs, invested a lot of time and effort, and Monbiot estimates £800,000 in order to draw up these plans, and reached what looked like a pretty sound agreement with the owners of the site that they would sell the site to them, and they'd be able to go ahead and complete the community project. At the last minute, with a fair amount of shenanigans admitted to by the person who ultimately ended up buying the site. The site was sold to another interest, and the community's plans fell through. So Monbiot takes this as as an example of a broader weakness. Communities, he thinks, should be able to design their own urban landscape. They should have control over the place that they live in. And again, that sounds like motherhood and apple pie. It sounds like the kind of thing it would be hard to object to. So he thinks that this failure by the Totnes group to get their design realised. The fact that they invested all that time and effort and money and that it fell through at the last minute is a good example of what's wrong with our planning system. He's in favour, therefore, of something much more like direct democracy at a local level and a very straightforward process whereby the community controls its own built environment and makes its own planning decisions. So, as I say, this case of his rests on assumptions which he hasn't articulated and stated openly, what a philosopher would call suppressed premises. And I think it's worthwhile looking at this not because the specific legislation or the specific project in Totnes are themselves worth looking at. What is worth looking at is the assumptions on which his case rests, which he hasn't stated, and which bedevil British politics, and indeed politics in the Western world, and indeed the whole world for hundreds of years. I'm going to suggest that Monbiot, like the Liberal Democrat Party, like the Greens in both Scotland and in England, he needs to take seriously the case that an awful lot of folk have taken time to think about this. Except, I made a complete ass of myself in the Herald newspaper about 4 or 5 years ago, when I got involved in an online exchange with an economics professor from Strathclyde University, Roger Sandilands. I emailed him and apologised afterwards. I tend to do things like that when I've really made a mistake. So I emailed him and he was very gracious about it. He was arguing in favour of a land value tax, which I hadn't really thought through. And when I had thought it through, I realised, as I should have thought when I was dealing with a professor of economics, that he was right and I was wrong. So Monbiot, as I say, is saying things about planning and about the effect of planning decisions on local economies. And unfortunately, I don't think he's really thought them through. The great Ulster politician, Carson, says something that stuck me with me. I've been a fairly frugal dougal, so I've got a few assets. Carson, I was reading something and an expression jumped off the page. Carson was talking about property, and he said, "What property would any of us have if it wasn't for the willingness of a working man to pick up a rifle and defend it?" And Carson was a great lawyer, and it went through me when I read that, because I suddenly thought, absolutely, absolutely. I sometimes go on holiday to Thailand because I really like places that are cheap and where you're not constantly being hassled in the street and where you get decent weather and you can basically schlep about and get fed and travel and it doesn't cost you anything. So I go to Southeast Asia, and a lot of guys who spend time in Southeast Asia, like a guy I met, Dennis, will buy property. Dennis bought his little flat in Udon Thani for £20,000. Very small, but quite chic, you know, quite nice. A little crash pad for £20,000. And I caution against that kind of thing for a very simple reason. If I'm in Scotland and I own something, like for example the flat I'm sitting in, it's because the word own means something. There's a register of property ownership, and I've got fair confidence that the court will secure me in my ownership. So indeed has the building society that gave me the mortgage to buy it. So I think that own means something. I think that there's a court that will say it's mine. I think there are sheriff officers that will turn up and secure me in my possession. And I think there are police officers who will turn up and if there's any threat to the sheriff officers. And I think if push came to shove and there really was a situation of anarchy, there would be military to the civil power, MACP. And I think soldiers would turn up. And ultimately, violence by the state would secure me and my property. That's what own means. So, what's the fundamental resource of a state? What's the fundamental resource of a community? Well, fundamentally, it's violence. Fundamentally, it's the legitimate use of force. The state has a monopoly in legitimate on legitimate force. So, the great resource of and that's why I wouldn't buy property in a country where I wasn't sure that they would support me in my rights. Now, the great resource of the United Kingdom or any other state is the ability to say who can do what, where, and what they have to pay. Yeah, that's the fundamental resource of the United Kingdom is that we can determine who can come here and what they can do and what they have to pay to do that thing. So if that's our fundamental resource, the next question is how do we manage our fundamental resource in order to maximise our interests, in order to make things as good for ourselves as possible? So what should we, for example, tax? I was watching Bettany Hughes, who's one of those TV personalities that acquires prominence at a moment in time and then sort of slightly fades from view. She did a lot of work on ancient Greece. On TV, Channel 4 type documentaries, and the Athenians, I think, demanded ton seton, I think was the expression she used, wheat, in their taxes, and it was a levy on every citizen, I think, fairly equally. The Athenians would levy heavier taxes, but by shenanigans. In other words, they would give you the great honor if you were rich, if people knew you had money. You would be given the great honour of welcoming foreign dignitaries and putting on a banquet, which is a bit like the King of Siam giving you a white elephant. You know, it's one of those great honours that bankrupts you. So the requirement of people to pay what amounted to a poll tax, levied without any great regard as to your ability to pay it if you want to retain your citizenship, that's one way of going about it. So the state could levy a tax that basically says everyone has to pay something. That probably leaves money on the table. That's probably not a wise way to do it. A number of great economists have looked at how to tax, such as to get as much money as possible, as efficiently as possible, and they've come to the same conclusion, people like Ricardo and Adam Smith. The way you do it is you stop people becoming what we've allowed, which is effectively little feudal lords. When you buy a house in Newlands in Glasgow, near where I am right now, you buy a house in Newlands, and they then build later. I need to check to be sure of my facts, but they build later, I think, the train station at Pollock Shaws East and the train station at Langside, and the whole Shawlands area gets developed and so on. You buy that house with that massive garden in Newlands, and it all goes up in value. Your house goes up in value. But we don't tax you much for the location. We don't tax you anything at all, really, for the location. We levy rates in the UK, and we allow essentially you to capture the value of the land. We allow you to capture the socially created increased value of the land. Because the reason why the house that you bought becomes more valuable is the train stations that straddle either side of it, that it sits in the middle of. And all of the facilities that are available in Shawlands and the hospitals that are built nearby and so on. So what we do with our system of land ownership in the UK is we allow everybody who buys property to become a feudal lord, able to extract rent, for that property. And they don't actually extract the rent usually year on year, although obviously when they become landlords and start renting the property to tenants, they do extract that rent. But in many cases, what they do is they extract the rent when they sell it, because all the value of the land in which the property sits is crystallized in the value when you sell it. Now, this business of land becoming very valuable when you acquire the ability to do something on it, that becomes obvious to everybody when there's shenanigans and bribery and corruption in a local council. You have a field sitting in the outskirts of a town and planning permission is granted. Well, if the serious organised crime people or the banks or anybody else begins to see large transactions going through the accounts of councillors who approved the planning permission, that's the point when there's a knock on the door at 4 o'clock in the morning and people get to go to Belmarsh Prison. Because, of course, the councillors hold in their hands the ability to turn £800,000 worth of agricultural land into £50 million worth of land, because they can grant planning permission and the houses will sit on it and be sold at enormously high prices. So the ability to demand rent from land, the ability to actually say, here's what you have to pay me to do whatever you would like to do on this piece of land, that's the fundamental resource that society has. And we've not recognised that. Or people in the know it, but they haven't found a political way to make that tell. They haven't found a way to explain it to the public. So what you find is that political parties like the Liberal Democrats or the Greens are in favour of a land value tax, but they can't find a way to explain it to the public. And in particular, there's a big problem getting to where we need to be from where we are. Because right now, for example, there's lots and lots of pensioners who've bought houses, or rather, usually their husband, family, they together bought the house. And they're now in their 70s and 80s with a massive garden that they enjoy. And if you levied a land value tax of, say, £16,000 or £18,000 a year, rather than the £3,500 that they pay in the council tax, there would be a political uproar. And these are the kind of people who tend to be players in political parties. So it's very, very difficult to get to where we need to be from where we are with a tax on the unimproved value of land. But be in no doubt, anyone who sits and thinks it through knows that the fundamental resource of the community is the ability to extract rent from the unimproved value of the land. And the advantage of doing that is that you ensure that the land ends up in the hands of the person who can make best use of it. Because at the minute, for example, to take an example, when my friend first became a police officer in London, I would sometimes stay out in his place in Ealing and then later in Acton and then later in Kew Gardens. And what you notice about large parts of London is that they're incredibly underdeveloped for such an expensive city, and the houses sell for horrific prices. And what you're faced with is huge terraces in places like Ealing and Acton. All these terrace houses that were built very, very cheaply a long time ago, and now they sell for huge sums of money. Because even just renting them to police officers, three or four police officers in one house in Ealing, allows the landlord to get a fantastic amount of money out of that location. If you actually demanded from the landlord a sum of money that was equivalent to the real underlying value of that land, say for the sake of talking, £26,000 a year, they wouldn't be able to find a police officer that would rent it. The cops would stay somewhere else and travel in the train. So the reason why the landlord is able to extract rent from the tenants is because they're not actually themselves subject to a land value tax that would extract the full value of the unimproved land on which their house sits. And of course, if planning permission is granted and the terraces are levelled and you get flats built which are 25 stories high, the flats will sell for £600,000, and you can charge, if you were charging a land value, if you were charging taxes, you could charge thousands of pounds for each of those taxes. So the community is essentially giving up its right to do what it should do in levying the most economically efficient tax. And it's allowing the benefit of the improvement of the area through transport facilities and communally created value. It's allowing that to be crystallised in the value of the houses when they're sold, and also if they're rented out in the rents that can be demanded by the landlords, because the landlords themselves aren't subject to a proper land value tax on the underlying value of the land and that on which their house sits. So the fundamental resource of the community is this business of saying, how much are you going to have to pay me to occupy this bit of the community? You know, and what we do in allowing people to buy property and own the land under it. And in the United States, sometimes people own the mineral rights under the property. Now, in the UK, we don't allow that. When you buy a house, if oil is discovered under it, you don't own the oil. And if we followed the logic of that through to the land itself, we wouldn't allow people to own the land in that sense. We'd allow them to own it, but only in the sense that the land value tax would mean that in some circumstances they wish they didn't. because if a land value tax is levied on the unimproved value of the land in which the property sits, you'll be able to sell your house at a fair price and get out of it. But you'll never be able to get to make the kind of ridiculous gains that people have made in London, because you'll never be able to crystallise the value of the underlying land, which is what we allow at the moment, because you buy the house and you own the land on which it sits. Of course, you don't own the right to grant planning permission, so to that extent, you don't fully crystallise the value. But we do effectively create you as a little feudal lord, and that doesn't make any sense at all. Now, what about affordable housing? Once you've grasped the idea that this land in which your house sits has got some kind of fundamental value for the community, what about affordable housing? What about the Totnes project? What about workshops for people who might not otherwise be employable or whatever? What about all of that? Well, it breaks my heart that people like Jeremy Corbyn, who claim to be in favour of a land value tax and continually speak in favour of affordable housing. God help us. Because if you stop and think about it logically, if you, for example, are the local authority and you've got the right to grant planning permission and crystallise that value in a payment to the council. So there's a piece of land, for example, and you're not going to accept under the table payments. You're not corrupt. So you're going to sell the land. You're going to grant planning permission and sell the land to a developer. And that money's going to go into the local authority to pay for schools and social services. Okay, fair enough. So you tell the developer that they have to put 25 affordable flats in the block of 100 flats. What does that do? Well, it instantly lowers the price that you're going to get for the site. That's all it does. So you've actually just thrown away a huge amount of money facilitating people who want to live in inner London but who can't afford to live there. And you say, oh, but it's created affordable housing, it's a good thing. Stop and think for 2 seconds. If the site is worth £20 million, if you allow them to just build 100 flats and sell it, and it's worth £14 million if you demand that they put in these affordable flats, you've just given away £6 million quid that could have been used to pay for social workers and child protection. Now, if you really want to do that, if you want to self-consciously do that and say we're going to have fewer child protection social workers in order to give people who can't afford to live in inner London the right to live in inner London, fair enough. But it's important that we understand that that's what we're doing. And similarly, if you think through the logic of subletting, which is exactly what you have to ban, and there was somebody in the newspaper 2 days ago who had been convicted over claiming welfare benefits when their uncle and I think one other relative were in Pakistan and they were picking up the welfare payments on their behalf. They were also apparently subletting their house. Subletting is a huge problem in high-cost areas like London. Because if you think through the economics of it, you're in exactly the same situation as New York was in when they imposed rent control. If I live in a flat in inner London and I only pay £600 a month in an affordable housing development, really, I would rather live in outer London and get a cash payment. My time isn't that valuable to me. There are people who would pay me £2,600. People who work in the City of London would pay me £2,600 for my £600 flat. I pay £600, but there were people who work in the City of London, financial traders, who pay me £2,600 for my little flat. I would rather take the £2,600 from them, pay £600 for the rent, and then pocket the £2,000 for myself and live in the outskirts in some cheap flat that I can find. So it doesn't actually, that flat in central London, that affordable flat, doesn't actually deliver the right amount of housing for my basket of goods. Because I'm poor. Because I'm poor, I can't afford to live in central London. And because I'm poor and can't afford to live in central London, I would rather have, if you're going to throw a huge amount of housing wealth at me, you know what? I would rather have less housing wealth, less housing utility, less housing income, and live in the outskirts and have more jam, more bread, and more holidays in the Balearics. So at every single level, something like a housing, affordable housing, is cretinous. It doesn't make any sense at all. But because it takes time to explain why it doesn't make sense, we keep doing it. And you're listening to this podcast right now, and you probably think, you know what? He's got a point. It doesn't make any sense. But the trouble is, how many people listen to this podcast? How many people will actually remember the contents of this podcast when they come to speak to politicians at election time? How many people ever vote on the basis of anything other than party label and a general perception of where the party stands? So a land value tax, like a single transferable vote system of election, is absolutely the right thing we should do. But the trouble is, it can't be done. And people like George Monbiot, who are not stupid. If you asked Monbiot whether he thought there should be a land value tax, he would say there should be. If you asked Monbiot whether he thought that the pensioners and the people living in these affordable houses could actually pay a properly calculated land value tax for this site in Totnes, of course they couldn't. So George Monbiot will be in the position where he's in favour of a land value tax, and he's also in favour of a community development, which would be impossible if there was a land value tax. Fundamentally, what you want to do with taxation is to... All taxation discourages things. That's what taxation does. It raises the price of something, and therefore you get less of it. So if you tax work, at the margin, that makes work less attractive. Because if somebody would pay me £100 to clean their garden out, to fix their garden, and that's just enough to get me to do it, then when I get paid 75, I choose not to do it. Because if I do it, the state's going to take 25. So the burden of taxation prevents things happening which should happen. You want your garden cleaned out, and I want the 100 quid. But you're not prepared to pay more than 100, and I'm not prepared to do it for less than 100. So 100 is the point where your garden gets cleaned all the weeds get taken out. I won't do it for 75, and you won't pay 125. So the state ends up not getting the tax, not getting any tax at all, because I won't do it. People think this is a marginal phenomenon. It really isn't. When you've done 35 or 40 hours as a solicitor or a dentist or a doctor, you're knackered. You're tired. My friend, the dentist, stopped working Saturday mornings. He used to work Saturday mornings and he stopped. And the reason he stopped was because when you've already worked Monday to Friday, you're shattered. Your shoulders hurt, the back of your neck hurts, you're completely stressed out and you are exhausted. And going in and working on a Saturday morning, when you're only going to get £40 out of every 100 that you earn, you're not going to do it. Because the marginal rate of taxation for somebody who's already blown through all of the other tax rates and is now at the point where they're getting taxed at 41% and the national insurance cap has been lifted and they're losing their personal allowance beyond a certain point. At that point, the tax rate is through the roof. And consequently, would you rather go out and have some beers, some Hoegaarden on a Friday night, and sleep in on Saturday because you're shattered? Or do you want to go and work and fill people's teeth and deal with patients? And the answer is you stop dealing with the patients. So all taxation involves hitting people and discouraging that activity. If you tax profits, then companies at the margin will worry less about profits, because profits at the margin matter less because the profit is reduced by the tax. And that all taxation does that. If you tax petrol, people buy less of it because it's more expensive. That might be a good thing. You should impose taxes on things that you don't mind discouraging. That's another good principle. Now, in order to encourage people to work, and in order to encourage companies to use as little of your territory as possible, in order to reach as much value as possible, you impose a land value tax. That's a very good idea, because it encourages all the land in the territory to be used efficiently. It encourages developers to get rid of sites that they're not prepared to develop, because they're going to get hit with the land value tax whether they develop them or not. It encourages people to consider carefully the benefits of working somewhere else, like for example outside London, because the tax that's levied on the area 60, 70, 80 miles north of London is so much lower than what you'll pay in central London. So if your law firm can work remotely, then you set up a branch office somewhere outside London. You no longer have that tendency to huddle in places. The reason why we've got so many Russian oligarchs buying houses in central London is because we don't have a land value tax that captures the value of the unimproved sites in London. So they anticipate London's property prices will continue to grow. And what that means is that London's land prices will continue to grow. As London, the great city state of Londinium, becomes yet more successful, instead of that being captured for the whole of the United Kingdom, it becomes captured by the people who at a moment in time had the money to buy, sometimes dirty money, had the money to buy a house. But they weren't really buying a house, they were buying the land in which it sat. The house costs nothing to build, it's the land that's valuable. And we stupidly allow all of that to go to the people who are just extracting rent, essentially. We're allowing Russian oligarchs to extract rent from the British people for their inhabitant, for their very being in the UK. We're essentially becoming slaves in our own country by granting other people the feudal right to demand rent for our being in it. This makes absolutely no sense at all. Now, in Scotland, things have been done to try and mitigate the worst effects of this. So for community rights to buy, but usually only at market prices, and rights to travel across the land, but not to stay on it, so as to at least mean you can still traverse your own country. But I'm somebody who most folk would describe as two steps to the right of Genghis Khan politically. But there's something that me and the left agree on, which is that the present system of taxation and the present system of land ownership makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. But like so much else, because the argument in favour of change is slightly complicated, and because it would involve a fair amount of disruption getting from where we are to where we need to be, it's not going to happen. Peace.